Definitely a level of uncertainty and angst on where the market's going to go into 2023. So right now, I think a lot of technology companies are focused on profitability and ensuring that there's proper cash flow. And a lot of that is due to how the outlook is going to look in 2023.
In this episode of the Executive Compensation Podcast, we have Kartik Balram and Darren Moskovitz joining us today for a bit of a unique discussion. In this episode, they're going to be talking about the differences in executive talent across the West Coast and East Coast, as well as differences between tech and banking industries. This episode is brought to you by Meridian Compensation Partners. Meridian works with compensation committees to ensure the most effective processes are in place to go beyond mere compliance with governance requirements and create healthy, dynamic relationships between the board, management, and its advisors. Meridian helps boards use compensation to attract and retain critical talent and to make informed business decisions that will link pay and performance, drive business results, increase shareholder value, and mitigate potential risks. Learn more at meridiancp.com.
Kartik, it's great to be here with you today. I'm glad you had the opportunity to join the discussion. I think we're going to have a bit of a different spin on today's Meridian podcast. I thought it'd be interesting if we do a little compare and contrast. Kartik, you work in San Francisco and you specialize in technology. And here I am sitting in New York. It's a little gray right now. And I specialize in banking and financial services. These are two industries that significantly compete with each other on across the globe and across the country. And today, let's focus on a little bit of compare and contrasting as to what are some of the major themes going on through an executive compensation lens and how companies are responding to, I'll say, shifting macroeconomic and talent dynamics. It's great to have you here today, Kartik.
Yeah, thanks, Darren. And like you said, I'm based in San Francisco. I've been in the field for about 15 years now. And my specialization has been in technology and biotechnology, focusing really on those two sectors as they're pretty prevalent and critical mass in the Bay Area and in San Diego and other parts of California. So I've been in the sector for the past, call it 12 plus years, really since Facebook went public 10 years ago. And as anyone who's in California and in the tech landscape, that set in motion a wave of IPO activity and a hyper-competitive talent environment amongst high-growth software companies, SaaS companies, looking for engineering talent and critical executive talent. And really, through that, at the forefront became late-stage, high-valuation private companies, or unicorns, as they've called it. I feel like that term has been used all over the place, but I've seen firsthand private companies benchmark to high growth public companies, shifting different methodologies in terms of how they set up their long-term incentives. And it's had an impact on San Francisco and on the West Coast in terms of their overall talent strategy and the way they think about delivering compensation programs. So Darren, I know you're New York. What's the deal with you?
Yeah, you're making me feel a little old, Kartik. So Facebook IPO, I think there's people that don't remember when Facebook wasn't a public company, but I probably predate even that. So I remember living through the financial crisis with some of my clients, which is now going back to 2007, 2008, which feels like a dog's age. But it's great to be here with you today. Kartik, let's set the scene for the audience and what's going on a little bit from an economic standpoint. And everybody's aware of the Federal Reserve's policy recently to tamper down inflation and aggressively raise interest rates. It's had a significant impact on both our industries. So from a tech perspective, I think you can reiterate or share that the focus has always been on innovation and idea generation. You know, as the cost of money has become increasingly more expensive, there's been some pullback, at least in the technology space. And hence, we've seen some announcements of recent job reductions in the industry. Not a significant amount of heads, but it still generates some noise and it generates public media attention. FS, not immune from rising interest rates. While in some businesses, that is actually a benefit to the P&L. You know, it improves some margins and creates volatility for some traders. It has certainly impacted or had the inverse impact on some of the fee-related businesses in investment banking, like equity underwriting and deal advisory, as deals have just slowed over the last 6 to 12 to 18 months. Interested from your perspective, Kartik, of what are the discussions that committees are having right now from a tech lens as they go through what is a different shift in economic circumstances and maybe putting a little bit more pressure on things from a talent perspective?
Yeah, so I think, a lot of what you said resonates with what's going on within the tech landscape right now. I would say definitely a level of uncertainty and angst on where the market's going to go into 2023. So right now, I think a lot of technology companies are focused on profitability and ensuring that there's proper cash flow. And a lot of that is due to how the outlook is going to look in 2023. There's a lot of recession fears. You can see that with the recent reduction in workforce announcements from Meta, Twitter, Cisco recently announced a RIF. So they're all happening to address cash flow and profitability. And then in the private company environment, which is pretty substantial on the West Coast, you know, you're seeing some down rounds in financing, but there's still a lot of money being invested. Don't get me wrong, but a lot of down rounds just due to the fact that there is a little bit of uncertainty going on within the marketplace. But that hasn't really impacted the demand for talent, specifically technology talent, technical talent, call it engineers, executives who have had the experience on navigating shifts in the business model from a pure revenue standpoint to a recurring revenue model, SaaS model, subscription as a service or software as a service. So with that comes a few things that companies are struggling with, I would say. First is equity spend, the equity budget. Within the past 10 years, equity compensation has been the biggest lever in the overall executive compensation program and non-executives. Grants continue to be aggressive, but given the state of depressed valuations across the sector, I think the market's down about 30% year over year. There's a struggle and challenge on delivering hyper-competitive equity within this environment, managing stock-based compensation expense, as well as dilution. There's a challenge right now on budgets continue to be high, but the level of equity delivery, meaning the value, is going to be a challenge to achieve that given the lower stock price levels. So that's one piece that companies are kind of working through into how to navigate that from a philosophical standpoint. The other is around incentive plan design. With the trend of moving towards profitability, companies are looking to make changes to their annual bonus program goals, as well as their long-term incentive goals. So historically, just to set the stage, the typical metrics have been focused on growth, you know, and then profitability. Some probably balancing out both growth and profitability. That's where the rule of 40 comes in, whereas others are going directly to profit or an ARR metric, annual recurring revenue metric. That's really one metric that a lot of these technology companies that are moving to a SaaS model or a cloud-based model are looking to focus on and communicating to the street in terms of what the meaningful value creation metrics are.
So rule of 40, Kartik, you said that's a term I've never heard of before. So here I am sitting on the East Coast working with banks. Right away, my first thought was, what does he mean by rule of 30? Help our listeners understand when a tech company says rule of 40, where the focus is.
Yeah, so tech companies that are a SaaS model, meaning that their software is an annual subscription or a multi-year subscription model. Rule of 40 looks into revenue growth and profit margin. And the idea being the sum of those two measures should equal or exceed 40. That's an indicator of strong, sustainable, profitable revenue. Whereas anything that falls below that, that's a flag where, oh, there might be some sort of cash flow issue or liquidity issue. So those are the things that a lot of investors, I think, are focused on in terms of the SaaS business models. And so you're beginning to see a lot of those types of incentive designs.
Interesting. Your story here really resonates with me, only in that I feel like the financial service industry has already gone through that. So if we go back to pre-crisis times, the focus largely as we think about incentive comp and incentive and funding incentive pools was largely on revenue. And then the crisis hit. And there was this significant shift, at least from investors, to focus on profitability. And there was a balance there for some period of time. What's a little bit different is when the regulators interjected into our process. And now it's much more of a story of risk-adjusted profitability. Now, there's more balance than there was coming right out of the post-crisis on focusing on appropriate revenue growth and risk-adjusted profitability. But we sort of went through that transition ourselves. And it really comes down to metric selection. And I'll tell you, that hasn't stopped to this day. So it's an ongoing exercise that's consistently evolving. And we're at a point in time where we're at the end of the year right now, where I like to tell people that this is the Super Bowl for every financial services organization as they work on managing pools, deciding the amount of compensation, allocating that compensation to their bankers and to their traders. But clearly going into 2023 with the pending recession and the views of recession and also the views of the Federal Reserve's policy, what will they do? What will they continue to do on the interest rate front? There's a lot of conversations around what are the right metrics on a go-forward basis for 2023. So is there revenue growth in that metric? What do we think on return on tangible common equity measures, which might actually increase in a rising interest rate environment? So my clients are largely sitting down, and once we make year-end decisions, I think they're largely focused on what should 2023 look like and how do we want to pay our executives for that year. Clark, I want to share something with you that I find really interesting that's probably just unique between our two industries that I think other industries don't deal with, but it's all around talent acquisition, but through sort of a geographic lens. We are unique in that, and maybe oil and gas is the only other one that falls in this category. We are unique in that we typically, historically, have been co-located in location. So if we think about the global banks that are out there, they're often all down in Wall Street, and they're often right next to each other, whether that's New York or Canary Wharf in London. And as we think about the tech space, you know, clearly Silicon Valley is known as being a hotbed for technology companies and technology talent. I think for the first time, probably over the last year, we've seen some significant moves to other locations. So we've seen some financial services firms for a variety of different reasons move to, and whether it's pandemic related or taxation related or whatever the case may be, we've seen them move to locations like Miami and Austin, Texas. You've had the same thing happen in the technology space as big companies have left the valley to go to those similar locations as well. So we've always had this war for, I'll say, IT and technology talent as financial services firms have wanted to gain operational efficiencies or look for quantitative developers or look for just innovative ways to improve their business operations. This is really the first time we're going to be sitting next to each other.
Yeah.
So put your crystal ball on for me. Like, we have completely different structures and frameworks on how we think about compensation. Do you think there's a significant shift coming down the pike, maybe 2 to 3 years, on how financial services firms pay their executives and how technology firms pay their executives, or is that not going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it depends. I hate to give that answer, but it's the truth. You know, to your point, technology companies are setting up hubs all over the US just to try and tap into talent, probably below the executive level, in certain critical knowledge-based regions. So Texas being one of them, Utah, I know Nashville is one that's actually coming up. I would say the crossover probably is going to happen in some sort of technology adjacent financial services company type. So fintech companies, for example, right? Combination of financial services delivered through technology. Think about banking apps, think about insurance apps like Lemonade, all these personal finance apps. But the reality is the talent that they're looking for is to build out these apps. So it's going to be predominantly technology-based, I would think. So it might be selective to certain types of technology-based industries, but I don't see any dramatic shift where I'm assuming financial services more cash-heavy, less of a focus on equity, technology really more of an emphasis on equity. So it's hard to really predict that. I would say in the interim, no, but you never know what happens down the line.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think in a state where we had rising stock markets, that technology model made some of that talent untouchable just because the buyout costs were so significant and your leverage in equity and your use of stock options and your use of those vehicles made it very hard to attract that talent from the valley to financial services. And it would also require to move from the fun and the sun to New York City and the hustle and the bustle.
What have financial services companies done?
I think what's interesting is I think there's probably an opportunity to re-engage with that talent, given how markets have come down and the value of their withholdings have potentially come down, which just opens the door for financial services companies. I don't think necessarily we'll see a significant shift in structures. I think financial services firms are generally comfortable with structure because it's generally backward looking and it's generally fungible, and they like maintaining that fungibility in their incentive plan design. You can only pay what you can afford. So I don't think we'll see it on a structure basis. So options lost out in favorability coming out of the financial crisis. I think they will continue. If they are part of the program, they will be a very small part of the program. But I do think it presents a unique talent acquisition opportunity for financial services firms to reengage that talent, which they haven't been able to do for some time. So I think there's an opportunity there in those selected markets, without a doubt. I think what will continue to change, and we've seen this in our clients for some time, is we've continued to see just changes in the way in which organizations work. And just being together in those markets, probably beyond COVID, accelerating those things. I think being located in the same spaces in Miami and Austin and in Utah and in Nashville, I think it will likely accelerate some of those things in those particular markets, for sure.
Yeah, and I think, even to your point, since there has been so much volatility over the past few years, there might be some angst or cynicism amongst employees looking for more of a cash orientation rather than equity, given that it may not have played out. So that might be one aspect of it. All right, interesting.
So, Carter, there's also a lot of regulatory and governance stuff going on. So the SEC has finalized two new disclosures, a pay-for-performance disclosure and a clawback disclosure. So there's new rules on both those fronts. One's going to be implemented at the end of this year. One, we probably have a year before the exchanges implement their rules and we finalize the clawback rules.
Yeah.
I have a view here that the majority of financial services firms out there already have clawback or malus policies in place. Right? That was a foundational requirement by the regulators coming out of the financial crisis. Clearly, if you are a global institution, European regulators were much more specific or mandated certain things, where the US regulators took a more principles-based approach to their clawback policies. But those policies exist and they're in place today. So I find that the clawback policy, my view here is the clawback policy, there'll be minor modifications to the financial services policies to comply with the SEC new regulation. But from a talent perspective, it will be a non-event, because anyone that works in this industry understands that it's just table stakes of being a services executive. My hypothesis is this is a much bigger shift for a technology company. We're coming off the backs of an FTX issue where we could make the case that FTX is a finance and a technology company. But I think we can say pretty clearly they probably don't have a clawback policy.
Yeah.
How do you think that's going to impact your industry particularly? And is there any concerns about attracting high, you know, top tier talent to a technology company?
Yeah, I mean, I look at FTX as a complete outlier. So clearly that's a case study of where a clawback has been put in place. But to me, this is a non-issue in terms of executive talents looking at the overall program and knowing that there's a clawback in place. To me, it's kind of an assumed piece of the overall package. A lot of these mature technology companies already have formal clawback policies in place. A lot of it is focused on restatement of financials due to misconduct or fraud. Now, the SEC's rule doesn't necessarily include those two. So it's interesting. It would be interesting to see if companies roll that back. I don't think they will. I think they'll include it in legacy and just amend the policy to be a little bit, to conform more to the different nuances of what the rule states. But you talk about private companies going public, emerging growth companies. A lot of these companies are based on the West Coast. A lot of them are pre-revenue companies like biotechnology. A lot of them are really getting governance systems in place as a public company. And usually that takes around 3 to 5 years to put in place. Now, you know, some may kind of, you know, a lot of companies, I can tell you, over the past 5 years or ever since these rules came out, have been in a wait and see mode, and some have adopted clawback policies just to do it, right? Just to kind of check the box, but, you know, and really include some certain things in there that will protect the company. But they're not trying to be leading edge. Some are, just because of, you know, obviously fraud and misconduct are two leading edge pieces, but no one's trying to get out ahead of it. And I think they'll dip the toe in, they'll set up a policy that's compliant with the rule, And then it might be an evolution, right? Like as they continue to grow and mature and there's significant risk out there potentially, start to amend that to include, you know, misconduct and fraud, because it is competitive within the market and, you know, companies are really wanting to protect that. Now, clawbacks I know haven't really been implemented at all, rarely implemented, but it is a good piece to have just to protect the company. And I just think now that the rules are out, companies will take their time. The exchanges will, you know, get them approved and, you know, they'll probably put it in place around this time next year.
Sure.
And for those that don't have it, it'll be interesting to see. I'm sure the board members will have influence in terms of what they want to see within the policy. But some companies may just do whatever the SEC asks.
Yep. I think one of the big lessons that we took coming out of the financial crisis is it's not just material risk statement would necessarily suggest an award be clawed back or recouped. Clearly, there's behavioral or misconduct item that should be considered as well. And it'll be interesting if the general industry takes a lesson learned from other industries on that front. I think, Kartik, that the pay for performance disclosure actually is, we're in for some interesting times over the next reporting season to see what these tables look like and see what results it yields. You know, I have a view that we have a pretty complex CDMA document to begin with, and we're going to make it that much more complex with multiple definitions of pay on a go-forward basis, which is just going to make it harder for the average investor to, I would say, distill some of that information. But we are going to see some, given the methodology that the SEC put forward, we are going to see some pretty significant numbers in those tables. Where will we go from here? I don't know. But at some point, people will aim to benchmark those numbers. And at some point, people will aim to tell a story around those numbers. So it's going to lead to a little bit more of a complex dialogue and discussion. And I assume at some point ISS will take a view, or an external stakeholder group will take a view on what they want to see in that discussion and that disclosure. This is probably a big change in our industry. And while right now we're all aiming to just digest the rules and do the analysis, I think there's probably over the next 2 to 3 years, some additional discussion that's going to happen in our publicly reported documents around these analyses. It's a little bit of a longer term view on things, but if past is prologue on these issues, Kartik, I fully expect these numbers to find their way in the Wall Street Journal and other media publications.
Oh, for sure.
Over the next couple of months, which always has an impact on the way that directors and organizations just think about their pay programs in general.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think right now it's a lot of analysis, a lot of legwork, a lot of valuations of historical awards that'll factor into historical pay and how it compares to performance, a lot of analyses around different peer groups. So I think companies are really just focused in the weeds on it right now. I think long term, you know, certainly I would expect results to come out next year with the new proxies and then perhaps some modifications to the disclosures, perhaps enhancements to the disclosures. But I anticipate that companies are going to kind of do what is required at this point, rather than trying to fully explain and get it, be leading edge in this regard. So,
well, Kartik, I think we've probably come to the end of our discussion.
Yeah.
Thanks for being with me here today. I would love to come. It's gloomy and cold in New York right now. I'd love to come see you. You can pick Miami or you can pick San Francisco, I'll come to you.
Yeah.
So it was great to catch up with you, and let's speak soon.
All right. Sounds good.
Thank you for listening. And we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Executive Compensation Podcast. You can see more about this episode along with additional executive compensation insights at MeridianCP.com. That's Meridian, the letter C and the letter P. This episode is brought to you by Meridian Compensation Partners. Meridian works with compensation committees to ensure the most effective processes are in place to go beyond mere compliance with governance requirements and create healthy, dynamic relationships between the board, management, and its advisors. Meridian helps boards use compensation to attract and retain critical talent and to make informed business decisions that will link pay and performance, drive business results, increase shareholder value, and mitigate potential risks. Learn more at MeridianCP.com.